Well, good morning. It is good to be with you on this beautiful day, and it is a privilege to be able to preach the Word of God to you this morning from Genesis chapter 32. Genesis chapter 32 will be our next reading if you haven't read it already. Has it been read, or shall I read it now? I shall read it now. Let us turn to Genesis chapter 32. It's an awesome passage. There's really so much in here that we will, in some respects, be scratching the surface, but it is an incredible passage as well. So let us give our attention to the reading of God's very own word. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male servants, and female servants I have sent to tell my lord, in order that I may find favor in your sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he's coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him, and the flocks and herds and camels into two camps, thinking, "If Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape." And Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, that I may do you good,' I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I've become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, 'I will surely do you good, and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.' So he stayed there that night, and from what he had with him, he took a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their calves, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. These he handed over to his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, 'Pass on ahead of me and put a space between drove and drove.' He instructed the first, 'When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, 'To whom do you belong? Where are you going? And whose are these ahead of you?' Then you shall say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a present sent to my lord Esau. And moreover, he is behind us.' He likewise instructed the second and the third and all who followed the droves. You shall say the same thing to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, 'Moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us.' For he thought, 'I may appease him with a present that goes ahead of me, and afterward I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.' So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself stayed that night in the camp. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had, and Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, 'Let me go, for the day has broken.' But Jacob said, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' And he said to him, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Jacob.' Then he said, 'Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed.' Then Jacob asked him, 'Please tell me your name.' But he said, 'Why is it that you ask my name?' And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, 'For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered.' The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two female servants. And he put the servants with their children in front, then Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He himself went on before them, bowing himself to the ground seven times, until he came near to his brother." So far, the reading of God's holy and inspired word. In Adoration, we've been going through the book of Genesis, and so I do hope to fill in some of the gaps where our congregation may understand some of the references a little bit more, but we find here in God's Word something rich. Beloved people of the Lord our God, I wonder if you have approached a day or an hour that you were really dreading. I think of a time in your life when you've had to wait for something really bad to happen. Some things happen immediately and they sort of catch us off guard, but other things we know come at us over time. We see them coming. Some of you here have endured a wait outside of a principal's office. Or you've waited for your parents to get home in time to hear the babysitter's report of your misbehaving ways. I've never had that happen to me, thankfully. Or more distressing, the anxious wait for the pain of a surgery and a long recuperation. Waiting for word from the doctors about an illness or an injury to you or a loved one. And time just slows down. That looming threat gets slowly and slowly closer and prompts a lot of questions. It causes us to wonder just what is going to happen. We end up taking slow steps towards something you dread, being sent to the principal's office, taking that long walk down the hallway. It's not fun. You're walking towards something that's not going to go well. Unlike the terrors which catch us totally off guard, these are the terrors that come to us in slow motion. A distressing turn in your path ahead with an uncertain outcome. And what do? We try to prepare ourselves for what's coming, don't we? If it's a diagnosis that we're waiting for from the doctor, we prepare ourselves for the worst. Oftentimes, that experience of waiting has an effect on us, doesn't it? An experience of waiting for something to happen, some next step to fall, is going to have a change, cause us to be transformed. And when Jacob fled from the tents of Laban, his father-in-law with his wives, and he heads west to the land of his fathers in Israel, in Canaan rather, he faces a problem that had kept him outside of Canaan for 20 years. This massive looming challenge, something he's probably thought of for 20 years while he serves out east. Esau, the brother that he had ripped off. He had ripped off his brother, stolen the blessing from him by deception. And his brother had promised, had vowed to kill him. The warrior king, Esau, strong and mighty, mighty hunter. If you recall the prophecy that came to Rachel or to Rebekah, when the twins, Jacob and Esau, were wrestling in her womb, do you remember what it said? The older shall serve the younger. If Esau knows anything of that, he's not pleased by that either. Now he's been undone by this young man, by Jacob, his younger brother, and he wants to kill him. And now Jacob, in response to what the Lord has called him to in the previous chapters, is taking step by step by step to get to Canaan, to Esau. A scene set forth in Genesis 32 is thick with tension. And intrigue and surprise plot turns. And what begins with a frantic and fearful Jacob in the opening verses preparing for this confrontation with Esau, we see how awesome it is that look at the way that it ends. It ends with him not frantic and fearful, but crippled and renewed. A crippled and renewed Israel, newly prepared by God for what is to come. The character change is stunning. God steps in here to prepare Jacob in the midst of Jacob's preparations for meeting Esau. And the results are life-changing, and they ought to serve as a lesson, an instruction to each one of you here. See your God at work. See your God transforming the heart of a prodigal with constancy and power. And here's the truth. It's not limited to them. It still happens. It happens to you. God taking hold of you. When you meet your match, you meet your master, and you are overcome by him. God at work. God transforming the heart of a prodigal. God prepares Jacob for a new life as Israel in this passage. He sets him on a new path.
as the head of the 12 tribes, with the name of the one who prevailed with God and prevails with him as now a servant, a man defined by God and not by his old tricks and deceptive ways. For the name Jacob means deceiver, and the Lord is going to give him a new name. So the first thing that we read in here in the 32nd chapter is a narrator's account of Jacob's departure from Laban. We read that Jacob went on his way. He'd signed a pact of non-aggression with Laban. They'd come to terms. They said, we won't come into each other's territory anymore. We're done with each other. We'll leave in peace. And now he has to leave. And in a sense, there's a wall behind him. He's not allowed to go back east. Laban has said, we've made a covenant. We're not going to go into each other's territory. So he's stuck with a wall here and Esau here. All that's between him is a river, the Jabbok, which is an extension of the Jordan River near the Dead Sea, about 40 miles, I believe it was 25 miles, 40 kilometers from the Dead Sea. He's at the outskirts of the land which the Lord swore to him. And the next problem is ahead. Esau is an estranged brother. Verse 1, Jacob went on his way, and Esau met him. Nope. The angels of God met him. What's this? Our text softens it somewhat by describing this as a meeting. I want you to think when it uses the word meeting, it's really in this sense, meaning a confrontation or a tense encounter. There's an aspect of surprise and danger and threat in the air at this moment. The angels of God, you could say, apprehend Jacob. What does he realize? These sentries, these watchmen are servants of God guarding God's camp. God comes to meet Jacob here at the outskirts of the land of promise, and the angels of God are on a mission of confrontation and warning. That's what the place name that Jacob gives to this spot means. It's Mahanaim, God's camp. And just as the angels of God were appointed to guard the eastern gate of the Garden of Eden, a land that laid west of where Adam and Eve were, so too here. Where is Jacob? He is at the point of entry into the land of promise. All that lies west. And he's at the eastern gate. He's at the eastern place. And where does he find himself? In God's camp. Angels of God coming to encounter him. Coming to confront him. Just a few chapters earlier, when Jacob flees, he's at very close to this same point, and he meets God. God then comes to him and drops a ladder, a stone ladder, down to him, a staircase, revealing himself, showing the splendor of his majesty in the heavens, in this dream vision. So there's something about this transition point from east to from west to east, he sees God. And now he's coming from east and returning west, and he meets God again. God had appeared to him then on the run, and God came down and revealed his word and promised to him. He promised to bless him. Those words would have stuck with Jacob as he served for 20 years in Laban's house. And now he's on his way back at the very lower reaches of the Jordan. He's coming up to Bethel, the gateway to heaven with its ladder and its stone. And Jacob realizes where he is. He says, this is God's camp. God's messengers, this angelic watchman guarding the place, confronting him. And what's the effect? He's going to end up in fear, but he's also going to speak to what his circumstances are in verse 10 in his prayer. We're going to see that he realizes just where he is at this pivotal moment. The journey he's begun in Paddan Aram in the land of Laban has brought him to this point. He recognizes the stakes of this journey. He is in God's hands. He's in need of God's favor and protection. And he's exposed to the power of God to punish him for his sins or to bless him. It is enduring love and faithfulness to the covenant he made with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. For God does no harm to him through his messengers, the angelic watchman. God holds back the sword. instead gives blessing. It's awesome. And spared in this sparsely narrated scene, we don't see much here. But we ought to see the location. We ought to see the name for what it signifies. Now he's been spared. He's not met his match at the hands of God. So now he resolves to tackle the present problem, Esau and his enmity with his brother. So he sends messengers before him to Esau and instructs them, "You shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have all these things. I have sent them to tell my lord in order that I might find favor in your sight." Commentators are quick to point out the excesses of Jacob's speech here to his older brother. His twin is addressed as Lord Esau and my lord. And Jacob says, "Thus says your servant Jacob, receive this that I may find favor in your sight." He's prostrating himself down before his brother. And boys and girls, do you ever talk to your siblings this way? "My lord, I am your servant." No, we don't. You wouldn't talk to your twin that way if you had one. But in this case, he must. Lays himself out. He says, "I am your servant. You are my lord." What's echoing in the back of our minds? What should be there? The older shall serve the younger. As if Jacob is telling Esau, "I've come to set that aside. I've come to reverse that. Tell you what, here's the deal. Here's our new terms. I will serve you because the other way has not gone well. God has said, but I will do. I will serve you. Accept my gifts, turn away your wrath, and I will become a servant to the one who, as God said, is to serve me." But before this plan can come into fruition, what happens? Word comes back to Jacob. The messengers return, and Jacob's worst fears are realized. This is not good. "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you. And there are 400 men with him." All this time on his journey back to Canaan, Jacob is probably working out how this thing is going to go. And apart from Laban's pursuit of him and God's confrontation with him, he's had a couple of things that have gone down on this trip. There's been little else to take his mind off the events that are unfolding now. What's it going to be like when I show up in Edom's land, in Esau's place? How's he going to respond? The messengers, look how short that message is. "We met him, he's coming to meet you, and he's got 400 men. That's not good. 400 men is a proper fighting force. Abram in Genesis 14 destroys four kings and their whole armies with 318. And he's got 400. That's not good. His meeting with Esau is not going well. It's not according to his plan. Jacob is known for his plans. They sometimes backfire. They sometimes work. This one's not going well. Verse 7, Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. The doubling up of adjectives tells you that this is an intense fear for him. He's in mortal danger. He's been caught off guard by the appearance of God's watchman, and he's thrown off by now Esau's 400 warriors. There's no time for him to scheme. There's no tricks. What's Jacob going to do? Is he going to scheme and deceive? Can he wiggle his way out of this? Not this time. The Lord is at work. The Lord is at work in Jacob. Notice the three actions that Jacob takes in verses 7 through 12. One, he takes defensive measures by splitting up his people into two camps in the hope that one, if one is attacked, that the other will escape. Two, he prays with fervency and zeal. Three, he starts sending presents to Esau in convoy after convoy in order to appease his brother. It's the prayer that should seize us. His prayer should serve as a model of our own response in times of calamity and danger. When you start freaking out because of all that is before you, because of some great threat, some looming problem, how do you respond? "Oh God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred that I may do good. I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you've shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I've become two camps. This is the prodigal's prayer. This is Jacob in a new state of humility, invoking God's name, calling on the promises God has made to Abraham, to Isaac, and also to him. Remember the covenant you made with my fathers, the vow you swore to uphold. He says, I've returned because you called me to. And I've returned with all of the things that you've given to me. It's as if he's asking, Lord, can my brother Esau undo all of the promises that you, God, made to me? Can Esau take away the very things that you've given? Can Esau thwart the will of God? Verse 11, please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children, that he would slaughter the innocents. Notice again in verse 12 what he says, you said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Can Esau undo that, Lord? Please don't allow either of my two camps to be destroyed by my brother. He humbles himself and he asks for God's help. And he reminds God, he speaks to God of the promises entrusted to him. Jacob prays and then Jacob acts. He sends out 550 total animals split into droves by animal type. And they're to tell him that these are all from Jacob and he's behind us. For Jacob thought, I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me, and afterward I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself stayed that night in the camp. That same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He sends them across the river in the middle of the night. That's dangerous. He's putting everything in front of him. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had, and Jacob was left alone. Esau is coming to meet Jacob, and now Jacob puts everything he owns and has authority over, his livestock and family, as a shield between him and his brother. He has prayed with steadfast devotion to the Lord, with humility. Now he acts to shield himself with what he has. Each flock is to act as a layer of a security blanket. Layer after layer after layer, and now even his children and his wives are to act as the final layer. He's willingly, openly giving them over to Esau if that's what it takes to appease his brother. Notice his wish. Perhaps he will accept me. But Jacob sees that there's no need on Esau's part to accept him. And he is acknowledged openly to God in his prayer in verse 10. An even more significant truth. Esau doesn't need to accept him. But what's more, God has no need to accept him. There is no need on God's part, Jacob is saying, to accept Jacob. I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. He is alone. He's outside of the promised land. He's empty-handed and vulnerable, and he has nothing, nothing to give. Not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love, and he's alone. And the attack comes. He's in the dark, and a stranger grapples with him, wrestles with him. How do we understand this? What's this moment in this scene? Jacob is completely alone, and in the darkness of the wilderness where thieves and jackals prowl, a man attacks him. He's at the lowest point. Now he's fighting for his life. Last time he was out in the wilderness in the dark, a ladder descended down to him, a golden staircase from heaven coming to him, and a scene of divine splendor made itself known.
And the angels were coming up and down, ascending and descending. What do we have here? Now a man descends from the heavenly places in the dark of night. A man descends down to Jacob, the God-man. The champion from Mahanaim, from God's camp, has come out to Jacob in the dark of night. And Jacob is fighting for his life. This is not some tussle in the tundra. This is fighting for his life. His wrestling is like that of a man clinging to life, warding off mortal blow after mortal blow. Jacob, his whole life being a grasper, a schemer, is now in the worst place possible. He's alone, in the dark, fighting an unknown assailant. Who was this figure? Hosea chapter 12 says he fought with God. A man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. This is the God-man, the Son of God. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Striking, isn't it? In this fight, Jacob's strength, after all, we sometimes think of Jacob as a weak man, but really in the narrative in Genesis, Jacob is very strong. When he shows up at Laban's home, he lifts an entire well cover that normally took three men. He lifts it by himself so that way Rachel can water her flocks. He also is prized by Laban because he's such a good worker. He's so strong. And we sometimes think of him as the weak guy that sort of hangs out in the tents, sewing things or doing whatever he might do with his mother. No, he is strong. He is powerful, as seen in various events later in his life. And now his strength seems to be giving him the upper hand here. He's holding his own with this assailant. He's fighting for his life, but he's still living. And then the fight ends. Imagine fighting somebody, almost thinking, I might be winning this. All of a sudden, one touch. Doesn't even have to do it. Doesn't even say anything. Just a touch. And he's disabled. He's broken. The man touched his sock and his hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Who is this man? Who has the power to change Jacob in a moment? The man said, let me go, for the day has broken. The first light was beginning to appear in the sky. But the night of darkness was coming to an end. Who do we have? Jacob and the man is saying, you must not see me. I must go. And Jacob is alone, lying in desperation on the ground. His strength is gone. The thing he delighted in is taken from him. What's left? He's clinging to the man. Hosea 12 says, he clung to him and wept. I will not let you go unless you bless me. Clutching with all that he has left. He's been reduced to nothing, and now he clings to this man in order to receive a blessing. Jacob meets his match and his maker. The man said to him, what is your name? That's how he responds. He asks for a blessing, and what's he going to do? He's going to change his name. What's your name? Jacob. Saying his name is a disclosure of his guilt, his iniquitous ways. Jacob, I am Jacob the grasper. I am Jacob the heel grabber. I am Jacob deceiver. That's who I am. Bless me, Lord. As with all of the renaming scenes in the Bible, we can't miss what happens here. The man blesses Jacob, but he does even more. The way of blessing is by claiming ownership of Jacob. The way of blessing Jacob is to give him a new name. By changing his name, this man lays claim to Jacob. This is the mark of ownership. Servants being given new names like Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach. The apostles like Peter and Paul being given new names as a mark of authority. And now the champion of God's camp from Mahanaim comes, lays claim to Jacob the usurper. Says, you are no longer Jacob,
Our text says, you are no longer Jacob. It could be read, it shall no more be said of you that you are Jacob. It shall no more be said of you that you are the deceiver. You have striven with God and men and have prevailed. You are Israel. He strives with God. And now, as God's at work in him, he's going to strive for God. Jacob's new character and destiny are given in his new name. He is a God fighter, or even a God warrior. As the prophet Hosea reflects, in his manhood, he strove with God. He strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. And now Jacob must learn who has laid claim to him in this new way. He asks him, what's your name? And the man answers, why is it that you ask my name? And the question is never answered. It's never answered because of what happens next. Then he blessed him. And Jacob realizes what was taking place. I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. In the darkness of night, the champion of God's camp wrestles with Jacob, and Jacob strives with God and seems to be winning, and then he's undone. He's overcome. The Son of God lays claim to Jacob, and Jacob lives. He's reduced to nothing by the touch of the Son of God and left. Do we see this, brothers and sisters, in the only acceptable posture before the righteous one of Israel, to cling in humble surrender and faith? Jacob is overcome by the Son of God. He's blessed by the Son of God, and now it is complete awe that his life has been spared and that he has been delivered from certain death by seeing God into new life of being with God. Sun rose. It's awesome, isn't it? The very thing to happen is now the light comes. The sun set on Jacob in the darkness of the night, and now the light rises on him as Israel. God's claim has been reinforced on him, and his new name, his walking forth in light, is a testimony to the plan that God has for him. He is Israel, striving with God, the God who has delivered him from darkness into light. Notice what our text highlights. At the very end, the sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, a variation of the word pineal, limping because of his hip. Bruce Waltke puts it this way. He says, the limp is the posture of the saint, walking not in physical strength, but in spiritual strength. The limp is the posture of the saint, walking not in physical strength, but in spiritual strength. It's not the strong. It's not the mighty. It is not those who are esteemed and held in honor by all. It is the weak. It is the broken. It is those who find themselves afflicted and troubled in so many ways. Think of Jacob limping as a continued testimony God had done something to him. Think of the Apostle Paul saying, I have this thorn in my side, which God is still using, that I would be humbled, that I would serve him all the more. Think of your life. How has God afflicted you? What are the ways that you are troubled? What is your limp? God has left his mark on Jacob. He's given him a blessing. He's given him a name, and he's diminished him in the sight of men. He's not strong Jacob anymore. He is holy Israel, set apart in the deliverer. Do we see that the diminishment which happens to us is God's doing? We talk of being knocked down a peg or two, but there's something far more profound that must happen in our spiritual walk. We must be turned from any sense of satisfaction in ourselves. We must be nothing so that Christ would be everything. Do we see that our strength, our everything must be diminished so that the Lord would be extolled through us? It is not our might in battle. It's not our intelligence, not our strength that brings glory to him, but our walking before him in humility, in love,
in desperate clinging to him as the only source of hope and life. Jacob is alone, broken, and needy. Christ says, I have come for the weak. I have come for the sick. The strong do not need the doctor, but I have come to my own, all who are broken in spirit. As he says in Matthew 5, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. We sometimes struggle when the Lord diminishes us. We struggle when we are afflicted, when we go through trials. We often, with a stiff upper lip, just want to bounce back. Want to get back on our feet. We want to be strong so others will see us as strong. The Lord is teaching us in Jacob. Jacob, from this point forward, as he is Israel, is a weak man, but mighty in the Lord. He is a weak man, diminished, the text says, limping. And the people of Israel knew that, and they do not eat the thigh of the hip socket as a continued memorial of what God did to Jacob to diminish this mighty man. As the descendants of Israel are called in Hosea 6, the passage you read earlier, come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us that he may heal us. He has struck us down, and he will bind us up. We want just a God who heals us and a God who binds us. That's what the apostle, or to the prophet of Hosea, is saying to the people. Your God has torn you down. He has struck you down. Diminished. Weakened. For what purpose? That he may heal us. That he will bind us up. As the prophecy goes on, after 2 days he will revive us. On the third day he will raise us up that we may live before him. Do you know your weakness before God? Do you see your nothingness, your diminishment? And how he is everything. How he supplies you with grace upon grace, mercy in time of need. Israel, Jacob, having confessed his sin in verse 10, been crippled and broken, is now set free to live a new life in the land of life. He is brought into Canaan in this most incredible way. What an amazing scene this is. What an amazing encounter between God and his people, Jacob. For the threat of Esau, the threat of death, had driven Jacob to the desperate fight of a dying man who must cling to the one who saves. A desperate fight of the dying man who clings to the one who saves, the one who blesses, the one who brings Jacob face to face with God and delivers him. God's camp, God's warrior king, God's claim on Jacob to change him to Israel. It's a stirring scene for us to take in order to see our own great need, beloved, to be humble at the feet of Christ, looking to him alone for blessing and deliverance. There is no other way. There is no other man. There is no scheme that you can come up with. Only Christ. Christ prevailed over sin and death in the flesh. Christ as the greater Israel, bearing our sins, taking away our guilt and debt. He is the name on our lips. He overcame Jacob and transformed him. He overcomes you, transforms you. He continues that ministry to you in this day. Christ, given for you, sent out to you to find you wherever you are in your dark night, taking away your pride and your strength and lifting you up in new life and giving you the name Christian, giving you the name of all who are named in Christ. That's your name. And you're a child of the living God, assured of it because Christ has overcome. Living each day then not in your own strength, but in his grace, his mercy and constant faithfulness. Hear and believe. And as the 10th chapter of the Hebrews makes plain, we have this unshakable confession in whatever hard place we find ourselves in. Brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, enter into the camp of God by the blood of God. by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is through his flesh. And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith. Love what it says next. With our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. For we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? Amen.